This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. This is a quote from today's book. It's much easier for a politician to blame outsiders than it is to fix problems within their own electorate. Very true. And how could these problems be fixed by a mere librarian? Perhaps with a bit of magic. This is the second book in the series of The 113th Assistant Librarian by Stuart Wilson. Welcome back, Stuart.
Hello, thank you very much for having me again.
Well, this politician is Annabel Clowrich. Where is her electorate?
It's Upper Lower Tumbledown Barrows. In the so this is in the city of Blackmore upon Wyvern, which is the setting for my cosy fantasy, a sequel to The 113th Assistant Librarian.
Now, this politician came across Oliver Wormwood, the assistant librarian, before. We learned in the first book that the books in this library don't behave normally.
No, that's right.
What do these books do?
Well, basically, because we're in a fantasy, Oliver thought that becoming a librarian would be a really mundane job in a really exciting world. But because magic exists in this world, when you have so many books crammed next to one another on the shelf, the kind of a friction builds up between the ideas, and they can spontaneously combust or spew out various ideas or creatures.
Or creatures. Now, hopefully, other libraries don't have the necessity of letting bats out at midnight.
Yes, well, that's a necessity because of the giant bookworms that appear every night. That can be quite dangerous if you make sure you don't keep their numbers down, which is what the bats are there for.
I'm just laughing about all the things that have come out of these books. It's the librarian's job to keep the books intact, but this story starts with a mammoth spider crab dislodged from a book about underwater creatures, and it's scuttling after Oliver, and Oliver is stuck between a mog and a hard place. A mog?
Yes, well, that has to do with the assistant librarian's assistant, Agatha, who did appear at the library hoping to look for a cure for her illness. We found out in the first book she did find a cure, but the unfortunate side effect is that instead of extending her life ninefold, it gave her the ability to split into nine cats, each one representing a different part of her personality. So his best friend now is Agatha, who is the sometimes girl, sometimes cats.
And when she is nine cats, they all have different purposes in the library. There's the Grey Reaper, who will claw anything that it comes across. Fennec would headbutt books so the spines lined up. There was Sentinel, six others, and then there was Harmony. Now, this is one they didn't talk about because Harmony was a bit of embarrassment to both of them.
Well, if they think about it too hard, it's embarrassing. There's nothing wrong with going to bed and then your cat curling up at your feet. When you think about that cat being one-ninth of your assistant librarian friend, it is a little bit awkward when you think about it too much.
Well, after vanquishing the enormous crab, Phoebe, a junior lawyer, comes to the library needing Oliver's expertise. And here we're going to hear from Stuart Wilson.
Yeah, Oliver applies to this expertise. Oliver hadn't heard that word applied to himself before. Expertise in what? Paper cuts? Crab herding? Over the years, our client amassed quite a collection of books, Phoebe explained. Oh, I see. A voluminous collection of books, in fact. And now that the grant of probate has been issued to the executor, the time has come to divest the estate and all chattels therein. Oliver felt his brows contort. Eh? The girl shook her head. Sorry, I've been working on my legal jargon. The senior lawyers tell me it impresses lay people. I don't think that's accurate. I think it only impresses other lawyers. Anyway, the firm was hoping that you could visit the home of our client, Philip Thomas, to see which books, if any, could be donated to the library. I see, Oliver said, glad that she had stopped using so many unfamiliar words. Well, if Mr. Thomas is able to bring the books in, I'd be happy to sort through them. That's unlikely to happen, the girl said, using one finger to push her glasses along the bridge of her nose. For Mr. Thomas is dead.
So Oliver does bring some of the books back to the library, and Agatha, who's a big reader of crime, found something. She discovers a denouement. What is that?
Well, so she's a particular fan of the Inspector Leng mysteries, of which there are 13 in this universe. And this particular book is called A Murder of Masons, and she is shocked when she is looking through Philip Thomas's copy of the book that the denouement has a different killer at the end of the book.
Quite a different ending. Another mistake was in Nana Fogg's cookbook, with a rather horrifying suggestion of garnishing a dish with puppies rather than paprika. Then there is a bestseller, a textbook used in schools, A History of Alpine Conflict. What's the difference in this book?
Well, this is a very big deal. A History of the Alpine Conflict is the type of history book that has kind of become history. So not only is it, as you said, taught in schools, it's the kind of thing that politicians will hold up in Parliament when they want to make a point. And there's a slight difference in the wording when it talks about the end of the Alpine Conflict. And it suggests that the border is actually 15 kilometres further to the north than their current understanding.
So would changing a border make differences?
Well, this is what I wanted to talk about. It's a kid's book, but I wanted to have kids think about the idea of history. And we know that history, first of all, is written by the winners, but also certain things, once they're put down in a book, have a kind of authenticity that takes on its own life. So the shifting of a border only slightly could cause all sorts of problems. Basically, the fate of two countries is called into question.
Somehow, politician Annabel Clowridge found out about this book, and Oliver refuses to relinquish the book until it's checked out. She needed a performance, so she brought out her puppets. What happened outside the library?
Yes, well, she has a kind of rent-a-crowd, and the idea here is that it's kind of an astroturf movement that perhaps don't really understand what they're protesting about, but the politician has been really good at riling them up, and they don't like the idea that the librarian is hoarding books and not letting them see them.
They set out a protest cry. What do we want? Books. When do we want them? Now. So they've protected this book in the Traveller's Portable Library safe. So what can they do with a very special travel book that's kept in the library?
The idea is that, are you talking about the portmanteau book, or are you talking about anamnestic adventure?
The anamnestic adventure. Big names.
Yeah, lots of long words. Anamnestic adventure is kind of like a travel book that's been written by lots of different people. So there are diary entries, there are printed entries, and they've written about places they've visited and places they've heard about. And this book is so powerful. It doesn't just transport you to the place described on the page. It also has a habit of interacting with the reader. So it might send you to a place from your own memory, or it might send you to a place that you've heard about from someone else. And they realize they could use this book to go to where the supposed border is and check the mystery out for themselves.
So this leads a whirlwind of fast adventure, caught up with the politician Annabel Clowridge and her soldiers in a hectic pace of writing, destinations and humour. Being followed on this jaunt across the globe from before hitchhiking back in a typical librarian way, it was just such a wonderful surprise, how they got back. It was lovely. Through these adventures, Oliver's five older sisters also used their skills to help their little brother. Even his mother came out of retirement. So what did she come out of retirement from?
Yeah, so it was hinted in the first book. It never occurred to him that his mother had a life before him. It was one of those things that kids don't really think about what your parents used to do. And he just thought, she just helps out around the home, that's all. But she actually used to be an Umbra agent, which officially don't exist, but she was basically an assassin, and we see some of that in action in this book.
So while Oliver and Agatha are travelling the world, who is looking after the library?
Ah, London Llewellyn, Oliver's friend who's a lamplighter. The lamplighters have got it good. They've got a union. They do, and they've got so many rights, and he's got his accumulated time in lieu that he's going to use so he can look after the library, which completely stumps Oliver, who has to look after an entire library just between himself and Agatha.
And he's got a break room and a beverage station. Oh, he's got the lot.
Yeah, exactly.
In the Lamplighters Guild. Look, it might be a kid's book, but you'll learn about bibliomania, the value of first editions, and how printing errors in books can occur so much magic and mayhem caused to manifest. It looks as if there may be more in the series.
There definitely will be. I am about to send book three back into my publisher.
And I hope I get as many laughs. Look, Oliver loves his job as the 113th assistant librarian. He knows books can be dangerous, but if the wording in one changed, could it impact the stability of the whole kingdom? Travel books help him leave and return in Lost in a Book, the second book in the series by Stuart Wilson. Well done, Stuart.
Thank you so much.
And from one world of books to another, I've paid a penny to the ferryman, Jan, who will take us across the River Styx to the underworld. But that underworld finds various incarnations and iterations in Sophie Laguna's latest and aptly named novel, The Underworld. So, Sophie, welcome back to 3CR.
Thank you.
Now, Martha is on her way back to boarding school. She has a particular affinity with Roman mythology, but it's a time of change and transition for Martha. What's going on in her life?
I'm thinking so many different things as I'm listening to you speak. I'm picturing Martha on Charon's boat, you know, Charon being the ferryman, and that kind of transition, you know, from life to, I suppose, death in the underworld. But the transition you're referring to is Martha at 14 physically changing as she experiences the onset of menstruation for the first time.
But yeah. her points of reference, her parents, aren't necessarily helping her. How does she see her mother? How does she interact with her father?
They're not helping her at all. In fact, you know, this onset of menstruation that I'm referring to happens when Martha is away with her mother. Her father is absent. She feels very distant from her mother. Her mother is aloof. Her mother is glamorous. And Martha simply isn't comfortable to discuss the body in all its kind of mess. And so Martha feels very much alone at this time.
So what comfort does she get from the mythology and what Augustus the emperor did with the deities?
Augustus paired the deities. So in a way, David, that makes her feel uncertain about her parents' marriage because they seem, at the same time as Martha is distant from Judith, Martha's parents also seem very distant from each other. So she feels they don't live up to this pairing of the deities.
And there's a certainty in the mythology. So Martha becomes more aware of her sexuality even before experiencing that first menstruation.
Yeah, it all happens at the same time, doesn't it?
But the way you've written it, she's been looking at a statue of Juno she kept rubbing, as Juno, no longer made from marble but flesh, reached for Martha with newly formed hands, the cloth falling away. So this statue of Juno almost comes to life.
It does come to life.
For her, yeah. In that moment. So, yeah, the imagined has become real.
And it's another transition, and it's interesting that it happens at the same time as interesting, every time I speak about menstruation, which I'm having to do for the first time in this novel, I feel confronted by it, even though it's me that's written it. It's as if we don't really have the language for it in fiction. I didn't plan to do it that way, but that was what wanted to be written about.
Well, it needs to be written about, but also
I think you're right.
What it is an underworld, so to speak. This underworld in her body coming to life, as it does with every child.
That's right. And it's interesting that it coincides with her first experience of physical ecstasy, and also with her preoccupation, as you say, with the underworld and the gods and goddesses coming to life. The gods, the goddesses that she's looking at on the pages of the books that she's reading, reaching for her.
And also it leads to her doing something spontaneous the day after. What is...
Well, a number, you know, different things lead to that event. So, you know, Martha's feeling increasingly physically uncomfortable. She's away from boarding school, away from her friends, and she's staying with her mother and her mother's friends. And she's feeling sort of cramps for the first time. She experiences this physical pleasure. Then she wakes. She finds it difficult to sleep that night, and she gets up and she goes to the kitchen in search of a glass of water. And there is her very beautiful mother swaying to the music in some very private world with her hair loosed. And Martha's quite intimidated by her mother's appearance. And Martha speaks to Judith, says she needs a glass of water, and Judith coldly points to the fridge. Martha returns to her bedroom, rejected once more, and struggles to sleep for the rest of the night. Can't bear to be in bed another second, 5 a.m., leaves the house, very unusual for Martha, very out of character, makes this sort of odd decision to go to the beach alone. She's not something she's used to doing, walking those dark streets at night. She walks out along the pier and she holds onto the railing as the sun rises. She imagines the light of Sol Invictus, god of the sun, filling her. She recalls the pleasure of that night before. She connects the pleasure experienced in that room with the beauty of nature. She leans over that railing and she remembers Persephone of the underworld. She strips off her clothing and she jumps. And we know by this time that she is not a strong swimmer. She's not a brave young person who deals with the...
out of character.
It's out of character. And I think I'm playing with that line, I suppose, between life and death. It all gets a little mixed up for this 14-year-old. Pleasure, goddesses, a place where we go after we die, the cushioning experience of being deep in the water and being in the embrace of Queen of the Underworld, Persephone. And it's a very dangerous moment for her.
But you also play with this notion of myth, because myth becomes immediate because, I mean, there's a story of Martha in the Book of Kells as a child. She's taken to Dublin. She thinks she's going to see the Book of Kells. She's fascinated. She's heard a lot about it and it doesn't eventuate. Mm-hmm. And so she's disappointed and acts up. But that then becomes a family myth about her behaviour. But it's myth today. It becomes part of the family myth.
That's right. As she says, stories that take place in childhood become set, you know, and you can't. There's nothing she could do to sort of change that myth.
Yeah, but myth is not something just in the past. It's something being renewed. But you then have another iteration because later on, Martha goes to a rural farm with some of her school friends, a holiday
break. That's
right. And it's a vast expanse, but that leads to a whole other view of the world, especially when she looks at how her friend's parents interact.
It absolutely does.
What did she discover?
For the first time in years, the world above, you know, the world of all that is above begins to take precedence, doesn't it? You know, she's really uplifted by that time. It's a break from herself. It's a break from family. It's a new concept. It's an expansive, limitless understanding of who she might be.
It's also what every child goes through, because you see things from your family perspective and this is how the world operates.
That's right.
Until you live in somebody else's home.
And she gets a new understanding for how family might be together and how a marriage might work.
And that is another underworld, so to speak. Martha couldn't recall witnessing such a warm embrace between an older girl and her father at school or anywhere. It was both difficult to watch and difficult to turn away from.
That's right. And that you know, that whole section, that break that she has on that amazing property ends with her gazing up at the stars. And she says, you know, that she'd read poetry about the stars, how they give one a sense of how small one is in the scheme of things. But she says for her it's quite the opposite, that she looks up at those stars and understands really her own limitlessness, and she feels that she matters in a way she hasn't understood before.
We get to the post-exam period, end of secondary schooling, mm-hmm. and there are all sorts of questions the girls are discussing about their future and how they see their lives. Martha doesn't seem to fit in, but one event in particular sort of fractures the unity between those students. How much can you tell us about that?
Well, that scene begins in a very optimistic way, doesn't it? The girls are dressed to the nines in ill-fitting gowns that of all, you know, they look gloriously terrible, and they're really celebrating their friendship and talking, as you say, about their dreams of the future, the travel they'll undertake, and they come from privileged homes and they've had this education, and so they're very bonded, and for the first time they drink the champagne from the girls' parents' cellar. And because they don't have a history of drinking, and because they're young, they drink a lot, and they race down the spiralling stone steps and throw themselves in the pool. That's right. And then when they climb out of the pool, Martha is separated from the others with her dear friend Valerie.
And inhibitions seem to be broken and such like. But so what we're getting is not just this transition through menstruation and such like, but also then into understanding of one's sexuality.
That's right.
And that discovery and exploration, mm-hmm. which they're all going through. So they all have questions and uncertainties and doubts, and are basically critical too.
That's right. And it was a different time. So, you know, they weren't as aware as we are now. They didn't communicate in the way that we might now. So much was experienced in very private sort of ways. And so Martha and Valerie share this moment. And it's interesting because they share that, you know, this very sensual moment in the cellar, you know, in the wine cellar, which is actually a cave under the house. And it occurred to me, I didn't do that intentionally, but it's the same, it's the underworld once again. I think, as you say, it's a metaphor for the underworld that we hold within us. And so, that's a very confronting moment, isn't it,
and
for the group?
There's also another school acquaintance, Cassandra.
Cassie.
Mm. Cassie told me she thought I was a man. But Cassandra in myth, prophetess, isn't she?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
See, you'll see things in the work that I wasn't conscious when I created it. I do explore gender all the way.
Oh, well, this gender comes out then. So we're getting different iterations of gender and understanding and awakening and awareness that occur all the way through the book. Because then Martha goes on and studies classics at university, something very difficult to do these days. Lots of classic department closing down.
Yeah.
But the sense of binary disappears. The next two frescoes showed me different depictions of Achilles wearing women's clothes. So how was gender seen in ancient Rome and Greece?
Well, I mean, this particular exhibition that you're referring to, and that you read from that section in the book, is exploring ideas of gender, the way artists often did lead the way into radical understandings of, you know, set ideas. So it was a very male-dominated society, Roman society, that Martha is studying. And yet she is drawn to a female poet, and she writes her honours thesis about the only extant female poet of those times, Sulpicia.
But what happened? What is the current climate of thinking where Sulpicia is concerned, and what does she have to break to get her understanding through?
Well, she wasn't. You know, scholars today are still don't believe. You know, there are scholars today who still don't believe that Sulpicia wrote that poetry. So Martha feels she has to defend the identity of the poet.
And this leads to Professor Mercer. How much can you tell us here?
I feel uncertain just because, you know, the book is so new to the world. How much ought I to tell you? Professor Mercer is a scholar, a renowned scholar, and he writes about the poet Tibullus, and he's very impressive sort of visiting fellow from England. He has a lot of power. The female students look up to him and admire him, and they're attracted to him, and he exploits that.
But it's then that iteration again of Martha becoming aware of her sexuality, where it lies.
That's right.
And her experiences along that spectrum.
That's right.
Sexuality.
And she can see the way other girls are attracted to him, and she's really been very closed off the past few years before encountering him. So he is an interesting sort. He plays an important part in the story for her. He's an opportunity, she thinks.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting encounter, because just as Sulpicia's agency has been taken from her by scholars, this also happens to women as well today, and in university circles as well.
Absolutely.
That's happened quite a lot.
And that's exactly what Professor Mercer is trying to do, isn't it?
Yeah, but this leads to another underworld, so to speak, because then what does Martha experience?
Well, I'm terrified to give away too much. I'm terrified to give away too much.
I want
to
know.
Well, Martha has always depended on the regularity of her period, which has never been an easy time. You know, you've heard that the early feelings, that separation that she feels from her mother right at a time when she needed her. She manages those periods by being able to predict them and by teaching herself to swim, which eases a lot of the discomfort in her body. And then after this night with Professor Mercer, she doesn't get her period. And
so she's quite worried. But you then do something quite interesting, because you bring together the water and the Latin, and there's a letter where you talk about that. And I've just got to find the right page. Being in water allowed for a less conscious or delineated set of thoughts. So you're moving through the borders of gender, of certainty, and these underworlds of how we perceive the world. But also, because of the fractured nature of the friendships with her former classmates, she gets a letter. And the way she reads one of these letters is the lines of the letter interspersed with Sulpicia's lines in Latin. And so the worlds have merged.
That's right. And I think that's the power of submersion in water, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it allows for
things become less distinct or more malleable, more not set in concrete.
The way they would be in the underworld for her, she imagines it as a sort of shadowy, sensual place where she can hear music. Music sounds like thoughts become filled with music.
But also then the various worlds, we shouldn't simply see the world as set because there are other worlds, there are other underworlds that are coming to the fore that are being recreated all the time. Sophie, we have run out of time. We're going to have to bring it to a conclusion. The underworld is brought to life. It merges and blends with our current day reality. Martha's life itself informs mythology, just as she takes direction and comfort from the deities in the past in Sophie Laguna's novel The Underworld, and it's a Penguin Random House release, Jan.
And I was in a different world. I was lost in a book with Stuart Wilson from Penguin Random House also. Thank you, Stuart. Thank you, Sophie. Thank you, David. Thank you,
and we better get out of this world. You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.